just so there's no mistaking, I'm going to go over first the bills that we already took care of yesterday or got off the list, even though we didn't republish a changed agenda. And again, Friday, tomorrow, we have a proposed 8:30 meeting of the Health and Human Services Committee, and that's in hearing room right here. Okay, hearing room B. And we have gone ahead and, I believe, published the agenda for Friday with the bills that we have left to work on today, so that in case any one of them goes over for some reason or another, we can work on it tomorrow. If we do not, if we're able to cover all of these things this morning, we will not have a meeting tomorrow.
Good. But I have one at that same time as you, that I chair tomorrow night. I'm very awkward to try to run out of that one.
It's always been my desire to drag a chair away from his meeting.
Yes.
The bills that have already been worked are already taken care of are SB 684, 2108, 2146, 2703, 3031, 3093, and 3529. So if anyone came here by accident to work on those bills today, they're either on the way to the House or they've been scuttled. So
it's just as Senator Lynn says, they've gone to sleep.
Oh, they've gone to sleep. Okay. I'm going to open public hearing on House Bill 2178 and call Representative Knopf.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Tim Knopf, State Representative from District 54. I'm here actually today to talk a little bit about House Bill 2178, and with your permission, I'd like to bring up Mrs. Jerry Cromwell and a couple of people who are X-ray technicians. Is that okay?
Perfectly fine. Just have them go ahead and testify in whatever order you like.
Okay. House Bill 2178 started out as an agency bill, and there's a long history behind X-ray technicians and the Board of X-ray Technology this session. There was quite a bit of wrangling between the board and their X-ray technicians about some fee increases in their budget early on in the session. Ways and Means Committee, the subcommittee that was handling that budget originally passed it out. The full Ways and Means sent it back. As you may or may not know, the health boards typically are done in one single bill. There's about 14 boards. The bill is 5026, and there's a fee bill that goes with it, 5027. Ways and Means pulled out this particular board out of that bill and moved the rest of them on and passed them out. However, the other bills still sit in their committee because they were concerned about the fee increases and the controversy that's been happening with the board. And the board and the X-ray technicians didn't seem to be communicating very well. And so what we decided to do is sit down with the X-ray technicians and try to figure out what had gone wrong. And so House Bill 2178 is some of the things that they were concerned about that were amended into House Bill 2178. And most of those, if not all of them, were pretty much agreed to by the board. So I think we have a dialogue going. And I think it would be beneficial to pass this bill and then get the dialogue started now on the budget and the fee bill for this particular board. And at this time, I'd like to turn it over to Mrs. Jerry Crummel, and there's Randy Harp here, who's part of the X-ray technicians, and I think both of them have some testimony regarding the bill.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Chairman Fisher and members of the Senate Health and Human Services Committee, for the record, my name is Jerry Crummel. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2178. I have been a registered radiologic technologist for 30 years, and before moving to Oregon, I was educational coordinator of the School of Radiologic Technology at the University of Tennessee. In Oregon, I supervise the students from Portland Community College at Portland Adventist Medical Center. And after passing the additional specialty of mammography, I've been concentrating my efforts in this scope of practice. I have presented numerous courses for continuing education on many topics relevant to radiological technology. The Board of Radiological Technology originally introduced this bill. However, the bill has been amended to reflect the concerns of the stakeholders and to provide the Ways and Means Committee a more acceptable budget. On page 1, line 11, the approved school accredited by the Joint Review Committee on Education is the standard used by all accredited hospitals. The American Registry of Radiologic Technology is the standard for ensuring the most qualified technologists are caring for the public. The ARRT was founded in 1922. Its sole purpose then and now is to regulate the individuals qualified in safe and effective application of x-rays for medical purposes. Most states and federal regulatory organizations use the ARRT as the basis by which to set standards. The Food and Drug Administration is the regulatory body for the practice of mammography. You must be registered by the ARRT in the specialty of mammography to perform mammograms in the United States. The reason I have given the background on the ART is the fact that you will be seeing these initials throughout the amendment, as in Section 4, Case 3, Line 30, and also on Page 3, Section 5, Line 39. These sections will allow the board to recognize the credentials and the continuing education provided by the ARRT. This will allow the budget of the board to be reduced to an appropriate amount. And as Representative Knope has stated earlier in the session, the budget for the board was originally in House Bill 5026 and 5027 and was pulled out by the Ways and Means Committee. There are two bills waiting in the committee to provide the budget for this board. I believe that the amendments will enable the budget to be reduced. The administration will not have the expense of providing documentation for the continuing education. Providing a copy of the ARRT card will accomplish this. I feel these amendments will ensure the safe and professional care for the public while not subjecting the technologists to an unreasonable licensure fee. I would like to ask your support for House Bill 2178, and if you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Hart.
Chair Fisher, committee members, my name is Randy Hart, and I'm the past president of the Oregon Society of Radiology Technologists and the chair of the Liaison Committee. And I'm here to just support Jerry and her. We work closely with her since we're all RTs, and also with the folks in Bend, and to get the things ironed out that we need to. And I'm fully in support of 2178 going further on as amended. And I would look for your support in this, and also the budget bill, House Bill 5058, which would fund this, and House Bill 5065, which would be the fee size. And I'm just here for any questions.
Okay. I'm just trying to figure out how to do this. We don't get Senator Shields back, and he wished to vote. Maybe I'll just bring these up and allow him to vote afterwards.
Yes.
That's probably even, rather than trying to...
Oh, yes, it'd be a simple...
Yeah, he's in the salmon in there, committee in there.
Mr. Chair, may I ask you a question?
Senator Duncan.
I'm just curious. Representative Butler's no vote was it a budgetary concern?
It was, his concern was with the budget, we asked him, and it was because of the problems with the budget, and he said that since this is what we're doing to work through that budget, that it was...
If I could just add to that, Representative Knope, there was some sentiment on the Ways and Means Committee that potentially that this board could be eliminated. And as we talked with the stakeholders, the radiologic technologists really didn't wish for that to happen. They really wanted to start a dialogue and try to solve some of these problems with the board agency and the agency head. And I think we've got that dialogue started now, and I don't really think that's necessary, but I was amazed that there was some sentiment to actually do that. So we feel like that this is a good dialogue that's going on, and we just want to continue that dialogue because I think the X-ray technicians are concerned about safety of customers as well as having a board that's working with them, not necessarily treating them as the enemy. And I think we all know that consensus is a better way to go as opposed to, you know, everybody being adversaries. So I think we've got that started, and I think this bill will help to continue that relationship.
Thank you. I'm glad to hear that progress is being made because that is an extremely frustrating thing. I've been aware of more than one situation since I've been in the legislature and before where boards are certainly less than friendly to their own people. And we've taken steps before and some fairly healthy steps to ensure that action ceases and that we do establish a reasonable relationship between the board and its licensees or registrants or certificants or whatever you want to call them. We have seem to have two or three different definitions here of how licenses and certain educational requirements are granted and titled. So I'm glad to hear that perhaps things are on a heads-up basis, and it sticks in my mind that just a few days ago we were working on a bill here to allow some of the ones that had thought they would not need to be licensed to be relicensed and take care of that particular problem that has cropped up. And I hope that also will work with this bill to help that situation out. Ma'am, did you wish to testify here?
The only thing I can say is that I...
Would you just say? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hart, for signing your seat.
Thanks, Randy. I'm Ann Warden, and I live in Salem, Oregon, and I am a registered radiologic technologist since 1961. And I believe that this is a bill that will help the profession move forward, and I'm very pleased with the backing of the technologists around this, and particularly even the continuing education that is going to be... that we can use the AIRT as our credentialing body, which it is, but also to use it for our continuing education will be very helpful to us.
Incidentally, does the use of AIRT, does that help in reciprocity? I would hope that states were working toward reciprocity.
And, yes, that does exist, yes. ASRT is the American Society of Radiologic Technology, and that is the parent organization of the professional organization, Oregon Society of Radiologic Technologists, and they work conjointly with the AIRT, who is the American Registry of Radiologic Technology.
Is there anyone else that wishes to testify concerning Hospital 2178A? Apparently no one. Any further questions? The board needs... Oh.
Roger.
I didn't see you standing there.
Oh, I was over there looking at it.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2178 and open a work session on House Bill 2178.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you very much for coming, and thank you, Representative Cano.
Sure, I'll move 2178. No, then, I guess.
It's an A.
I move 2178A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Duncan moves House Bill 2178A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Objections? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Okay. Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Senator Shannon?
Aye.
Senator
Keough?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye. And, we will pick up Senator Shields a little later time. So the bill has passed, and the motion is passed, and Senator Duncan will do the carry. Close the work session on House Bill 2178. Try to see it keep up from one page to the next here. I believe they're ready. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 2267.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2267 changes the registration certification of physician assistants to licensure by the Board of Medical Examiners, and it also requires education and passage of examination for licensure as physical assistant. We have a couple of proposed amendments. The Dash 82s would add an education exam requirement for licensure as a physician assistant. Currently in the law, the training is approved by the board, and that is how an application is made. There are no specific requirements stated in the statute. This would put the specific requirements on education and exam passed into the statute. We also have the Dash A3 amendments, which is a conflict resolution amendment. The best I can tell, it resolves conflicts with Senate Bill 460, which was signed into law.
Okay. Jeff, go ahead, Mr.
Thank you, Chair Cruz, members of the committee. And just so we can make it a little more simple, let's take Chair Fisher. Sorry. Jeff Watkins with the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants. Let's just make things easier and take the A2s, and we'll put them in a file and not have to worry about those. We decided not to have those into the bill.
They wish not to have the A2s.
House Bill 2267 is a housekeeping bill and would clear up confusion experienced by insurers and others by standardizing terms within the Medical Practices Act and our little section of that. And as the committee administrator said, it changes the term certified and registered to licensed within the definition section for the entire, so it conforms with the definitions for the entire chapter. An equivalent bill, Senate Bill 238, passed both chambers in the 1995 session, but was vetoed because of a controversial unrelated amendment. Committee members, this is not a huge problem, but it does cause some time and effort and money trying to clear people up on this. Sending the party, whoever it is that's confused about our status, a letter letting them know that the Board of Medical Examiners, everything that they do is basically licensure, and we cite the statute there that kind of says that. And it's just kind of supporting documents, the second page of the testimony is a letter from the Board of Medical Examiners that says we're already basically licensed and they're in support of this bill. And then the third page is a copy of the letter that we've had to send to all of our members to help them deal with this headache that we have to go through. And it's just describes the situation. And we have a form letter that we can send to the insurer or whoever it is that's confused about it. And it lays out the statute for them. It says, if you have any questions, call the Board of Medical Examiners. And so really when we're saying that we're changing something, it's kind of a misnomer. We're already actually licensed. The piece of paper that comes from the Board of Medical Examiners says license on it. And this just kind of clears all that up. And it would really, it doesn't have anything to do with our scope of practice or anything like that. It's just a very simple bill. And it will eliminate the time and effort otherwise spent on clearing up this confusion. Thank you.
We have the one amendment to resolve conflicts, the A3, I didn't support that.
We just became aware of it, but let's move the bill and we'll look at that later and go from there. We're okay with it for now.
Okay. Christian.
Hi, just real quickly, my name is Scott Beyer. I'm the president of the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants. I'm also a practicing PA in Portland. I've been practicing for about 9.5 years. One of the confusions that happen that we get a lot of phone calls about is the fact that PAs practice, and a lot of the different durable good companies and other nursing homes require that that in some of their rules that they that the word licensed provider is listed. So, for instance, a good example would be in some rural areas we have people call us up who can't prescribe oxygen for a patient because the durable goods company says only a licensed provider. So every single time we have to send off these letters to them to try to get this cleared up. And we think that this is just going to be a very simple thing in the regards that that there's just been this confusion as regards to all three titles listed, certified, registered, and licensed. But we know we're licensed. The BME has called us licensed ever since I've been here and before that. And we just would like to get that clarified once and for all.
Okay. Yes, we have no one else signed up. Anyone else wish to testify? Hearing none, I will close the public hearing on Senate, our House Bill 2178A and open the workstation on House Bill 2178. I'm sorry. Looking at one and reading the other. House Bill 2267, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2267A and open a workstation on House Bill 2267A3.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'll move 2267A to the...
We need to add a dash 3 amendment.
Yeah. You want to move the dash 3?
Yes.
Move dash A3.
Senator Shields, move the dash A3 amendment to House Bill 2267A. Further discussion? Objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Now, can I move?
Yes, sir.
I'll move 2267 as amended to the past recommendation.
Senator Shields has moved House Bill 2267 as amended with the dash 3 amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion or objections? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Shannon?
You wish to hear
aye.
Senator Shields?
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye. And Senator Shields has said he would be the carrier, and the motion is passed. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2267A and open a work session again on House Bill 2178A for the purpose of allowing Senator Shields to cast a vote. Senator Shields, how do you vote?
I vote aye. And our clerk caught up. Okay.
Okay, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2178A. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3538. And call Representative Simmons and whoever else is with Representative Simmons. Morgan Holmes. I'll ask you to go ahead, Matt. Send it whenever you wish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fisher, members of the committee, I appreciate you taking the time to hear House Bill 3538 today. And we do have some dash A2 amendments that have been prepared. The bill embodies the concept of a community health team healthcare. For a community healthcare representative comes from a task force sponsored by the Center for Human Development Incorporated, a private nonprofit in Eastern Oregon in the Grand. And the team approach received the support and endorsement of the Oregon Department of Human Resources and the Mental Health and Developmental Disability Services Division. In House Bill 3538, it authorizes the Department of Human Resources or its designee to develop administrative rules establishing an individual support team to make health care decisions provided the individual is incapable as defined by Oregon or by statute, has not appointed a health care representative, does not have a guardian with the power to make health care decisions on his behalf, and receive services from the Department of Human Resources or its designee or other agency that provides custodial care. The health care providers are requiring a responsible person with authority to consent, refuse to consent, or withdraw consent for health care. The proposal has no impact on existing procedures such as guardianships, conservatorships, or mental commitments. The individual support team is intended to provide a prompt process for making health care decisions which are more timely and less expensive than the emergency guardianship court process. I would urge your support of the bill, and I was not part of the work group that put together the A2 amendments, but I believe there are people here who can testify to that.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jacqueline Zimmer, and I'm the director of the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. And I just received the A2 amendments yesterday and wanted you to be aware that we as the AAAs had a concern with this initially in this bill, and I think some of you might have heard about that, and that was because case managers were deemed to be the team leaders for this so-called guardianship bill, and we were concerned about the fiscal impact on our case managers if they had to assemble a team of people to help make healthcare decisions for a client, and we felt that that wasn't recognized over in the House, So we did object to the bill when it was in the House. As it stands today, and without being able to touch base with the people in my field who would kind of give me an up or down on this, I think that we will be all right with this bill if it does, as Representative Simmons says, and if it, in fact, helps out in sort of crunch situations where there's just sort of nobody around to help somebody who needs some minor care or dental work or something along those lines that might require anesthesia. So we don't see this as being a healthcare team that's appointed for life for this individual, unless that individual requests it. But I think at this point we are okay with this bill.
Representative Simmons, now are you referring to the A2 amendment?
Yes, the A2 amendments are before us, sir.
And that's what you're supporting?
Yes.
Okay, which basically is a complete overhaul from stem to stern, gut and stuff, is it?
Yes.
Can I get okay.
Yes.
Chairman Fisher, members of the committee, my name is Tina Kitson. I am the medical director for the Office of ED Services. I participated along with my colleagues over at SDSC in the Dash 18 amendments, and although it looks like it could be a gut and stuff, what it is it's the essential elements of the Dash A amendments written in a bit more clear form and with a couple of more safeguards added to address the concerns that were raised in the House side. It really, if you wish, I can sort of walk through the major changes. On page 2, line 6, it clarifies exactly who would be eligible for this health care team, and it limits it compared to the Dash A amendment in a way that I think is very, very helpful. Page, the other really major change is on page 4, line 18, where it requires the healthcare team to concur with any decisions that are made, which makes this pulls the decisions out of any sort of controversial decision. If there's controversy, it makes it very clear that you have to go to guardianship or something else that has much more specified protections within it.
Senator Fisher, may I ask a quick question?
Yeah.
Did I hear Representative Simmons say I was not a part of these, but I do support them?
Yes, yes. Senator Shannon, that's correct.
Okay.
Okay, we have...
Can I give my testimony?
Pardon?
Can I?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Is this right? Okay.
No, go ahead.
again, Chairman Fisher, members of the committee, my name is Tina Kitchen. We are the people who have used the healthcare representative team idea for the last 3 years as authorized under ORS 127. What we have found in the past is that as the medical system became more sophisticated, doctors and hospitals really looked for somebody who was legally authorized to sign on the bottom line for consent. And within our service system, we found, not on a regular basis, but on an irregular basis, individuals who are not getting necessary medical care because there was nobody who was willing to give consent for this individual and they were incapable. So that if a woman had a breast lump and it needed to be biopsied to make sure it was cancer, this person sometimes sat for months trying to go through the guardianship procedure because there was nobody who wanted to be guardian. And so basis, but on an irregular basis, individuals who are not getting necessary medical care because there was nobody who was willing to give consent for this individual and they were incapable. So that if a woman had a breast lump and it needed to be biopsied to make sure it was cancer, this person sometimes sat for months trying to go through the guardianship procedure because there was nobody who wanted to be guardian. And so we went ahead and worked with this idea of a group of people to make these healthcare decisions for an individual who was incapable and had nobody else. And that's where the team over in Eastern Oregon got the idea. We do believe that the Dash 2 amendments are a fairly minor, well, I talked to you about the substantial changes from the A amendments, but I think it works much clearer and it really tightens up the bill. Thank you.
It's probably didn't get a chance to take these up before we got started, man.
Yeah, these
are actually. Yeah, is this the A2?
Yeah.
I had
much. Well,
you want to come up?
Thanks.
So two extra copies here.
No, that's okay. Thank you, Representative Simmons. We have Bob Jundup and David Neibel. Go right ahead. Didn't make any difference.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Chundeff. I'm the director of the Oregon Advocacy Center. I'm here speaking in opposition to House Bill 3538. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the work that the proponents of the bill have done since it's come over from the House, and I've just seen the Dash 2 amendments and read them, and I think they're an improvement over the original bill. However, I think that there are still some concerns that this committee will be looking at, and particularly from the legal side. What this bill would do is write into state law a mechanism for shifting a person's decision-making capability and create a unique system, both in Oregon and I believe nationally, in which that could be done under state law without any independent process. Right now, if a person is incapable of making medical decisions, generally speaking, a physician will look to a family member for an alternate decision. There isn't one available, then there are legal processes available for alternate decision-making. There's guardianship, the civil commitment process. People can make advances. Instructions for themselves using an advanced directive. But other than those things, where a person has given a clear expression of their wishes in advance and where there isn't a close family member available to make the decision, then the law considers that a shift in a person's ability to make decisions for themselves should have some procedural protections. Normally those are done in court. There are some states that have administrative procedures whereby there's an administrative panel that will look at a situation and make a decision as to whether a person's unable to make decisions for themselves and whether the decision being made is appropriate. But this bill does certainly, in an effort to address the needs of certain individuals, is it makes essentially an automatic shift in that decision-making ability from the individual to a government agent that is either a member of a government agency or a contractor with that agency, and they can go ahead and make those decisions. Under the bill, the decisions are not limited to minor tooth repair type of decisions. They can go all the way to major surgery, the provision of major antipsychiatric drugs, experimental treatments. It's pretty wide open. So our concerns primarily have to do with the procedures involved, and our feeling is that there should be a legal look at these procedures to see if they meet constitutional requirements.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm David Neville from the Oregon Law Center. My testimony will be brief. I am here to speak also against House Bill 3538 on much the same basis as Mr. Jundeff. One of the things that I've been doing this session is trying to upgrade the process that one needs to go through in order to form a guardianship over an individual who is no longer alleged to be, at least, no longer able to make his or her own decisions. And I'm afraid that this bill would enable an end run around those procedures. The guardianship procedure has been characterized as being time-consuming to follow, but there's a reason why we set up this procedure, and that is that these rights that are before the court or that are in question in those procedures are some very, very basic rights of the person to make their own decisions about some of the most important issues that they will ever face. Healthcare decisions, where they live, what they do. This is limited to healthcare decisions, but I'm worried that that we're starting down the road here of creating an administrative process without judicial review and with no explicit protections, procedural protections for the person whose rights are basically being taken away. So I, too, would express the same kinds of concerns that Mr. Jundeff had and would oppose this bill.
I'm certain that your decision isn't taken lightly here in these particular instances. Personally, I've been involved in two, three cases that have been very unsettling, simply because of the absence of anybody as a close relative. In one case, a woman's body was put in a freezer for 6 months, waiting to find somebody that could say where and when and why and how it should be disposed of. And finally, as I recall, a distant relative from Michigan had to come all the way out here to Oregon to make some decisions, and was only discovered after an intense search by an attorney after the woman's death, and she'd been about 7 months hospitalized in a comatose situation up until that time. Very, very frustrating experience, and we had a stack of mail 3 feet high waiting for her. The property was taken because of lack of payments. She had plenty of money, but no one could open the mail, no one could help out. It was just an extremely frustrating experience, and eventually it did get sorted out, but not until after she had major financial losses for her estate, and people had taken lot of her belongings and who knows where they went, this kind of thing. And I don't remember enough of the situation to know whether there would have been some health care that she could have benefited from during that period of time had she had someone that could have made a decision for her on that score. My guess is perhaps not. But it certainly brings out the problem that some people run into through no probably fault of their own, but lack of preparation perhaps in advance. Who knows when we're going to fall down in our front yard and go comatose for some reason or another and be found by a neighbor. So I can see the problems that people face when they're trying to give somebody health care and where something shows that it needs to be done fairly quickly and have to sit there and be frustrated waiting for some type of court acquaintance from the wheels of justice grinding exceedingly slow.
Mr. Chair, if I might respond, there is a temporary guardianship procedure that is designed to be used quickly for emergency medical procedures. There are some hoops. It does create some hoops to be jumped through. But in the case that someone needs emergency medical treatment and they are unable to consent or give consent, there is a procedure that is available under the guardianship statute for that circumstance.
Mr. Chair, I might add that generally the problems don't come up in emergency situations because generally physicians consider that they have authority to move ahead if there is an emergency. The problems are more likely to come up in a situation that isn't considered emergent, but it's felt that something needs to be done. And one example is the tooth situation where a person may need tooth repair. So that, again, there is a legal process that's available to have a surrogate decision maker, somebody else to make the decisions. But there is process and it costs some money to do it right now.
And who pays that money?
Pardon me?
Who pays that money?
Mr. Chair, the cost of that can come from the estate of the individual, or there are public programs that are established to fund guardians. I know Senior Services has such a program, and there is a public guardian in Multnomah County, although not every county has a public guardian.
Representative Simmons, do you have any particular comment or...
Thank you. This bill is designed to be applied, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in very narrow circumstances and situations. As I indicated earlier, the individual has to be incapable, as defined in ORS 127.505. He has to do not have any appointed health care representative, does not have a guardian with powers to make health care decisions, and is a resident of a facility or home licensed and certified as a 24-hour residential service providing a facility under Senior and Disabled Service Division or the Mental Health Division. It's worded very tightly, I believe, and is intended to allow decisions to be made when no one can be found that is a guardian. There's no relative that can be found. And I believe it presents a reasonable alternative to current practice. I'd be happy to go through the sections of the bill with you. You may have read them in the time that we've been proceeding through this hearing.
We were looking at the more or less the third part section here in Selfish, and we thank you that there are certain safeguards that this isn't going to just wind up everybody being worked on whether they want to be
correct. And if they find a relative who doesn't want to be guardian but objects to the healthcare team, the healthcare team can't be formed. It's worded very tightly, I believe, and the amount of latitude allowed, I think, is quite reasonable.
Senator Fisher?
Yes,
ma'am. Can I ask a question?
Yes.
How did you come about this, though? Who couldn't be helped? Why did they come to you?
Senator Fisher, Senator Shannon, there's been a work that's going on for some time in Northeast Oregon, Union and Umatilla counties primarily, that developed the original bill, and they had been working on this for 6 months to a year, this concept, as been utilized, as indicated by Ms. Kitchen earlier, to try to streamline things and provide a few less boots to have to jump through. And I gave them authority to work with legislative counsel, former DA in Union County, to help draft the original bill.
Another question. Did they demonstrate to you that there are people who are not getting served fast enough? Did they charge?
Yes, they did.
There were... well, I'll tell you, I read the bill, and at first I thought this was a bill about kind of helping people in care centers and things like that. And then I noticed, which I would have thought would have been seniors, like he said, nobody knew. But then they want the authority to require abortions of these people.
No. They are precluded.
I just read it in the dash, too.
If you go back, Section 5, bottom of page 3, the healthcare representative team does not have authority to make decisions on withholding or withdrawing life-sustaining procedure, withholding or withdrawing artificially administered nutrition, sterilization, abortion.
Okay.
They do not have the authority to do that.
Okay, that's good. Thank you. Answers my question.
Yes, Gordon.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would also just like to point out in this discussion about taking away a person's rights, in section or page 3, line 8, a healthcare representative team cannot be formed for the incapable individual if the individual or any other person objects to the formation. Page 4, line 14, an incapable person must be present at all the meetings. And line 18 of that same page, all members of the healthcare team must concur, meaning that if that person is present and disagrees with the decision, then it would require people to look at the guardianship, even though that's going to be a more time-consuming process than hopefully that's going to happen.
Thank you.
When you say the incapable person must be present at the meeting, I mean, this is the incapable person in contrast. If they're incapable, what difference does it make if they're at the meeting? And I don't quite follow.
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, in my experience as a physician and with people with developmental disabilities, people are not totally capable or totally incapable. A person with a developmental disability who may not even have any words to use may be very capable of picking out which outfit they want to wear or whether or not they want corn puffs or oatmeal that morning for breakfast, but be very incapable of understanding whether or not they should have chemotherapy or radiation therapy for, you know, their cancer. So this is an attempt to make sure that the person is involved as much as possible, and to give those situations where somebody might be trying to railroad their rights, give them a chance to object.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Okay. I did that to set up this question. You can have an incapable person present, but if you have a discussion going on between this team could be using language which is perfectly, you know, logical to them, and the incapable person would have no idea what they're talking about. In that process, is there any attempt to translate from the level of the doctors and so on that are talking to this person in a language that they can understand what's actually being discussed.
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields,
would guarantee that?
We address that within the administrative rule process. We require that the team make a decision that the person is not able to make the decision themselves by using the words that the person most likely is able to understand and getting very concrete, because we do see that that is a potential problem that's necessary. So this statute gives us the authority to write the rules, and I would anticipate things like that would be addressed within the rulemaking process.
Yes. But there's nothing to guarantee that that would be written in rule in this statute here.
Within, Mr. Chairman, Senator Shields, within the statute on page 3, line 5, there's the requirement that the team take into account any desires expressed by the incapable individual. I would interpret that as requiring me to include that sort of process within my rule.
3, line 5?
I'm sorry. Page 3, line page 3, line 11, section 5, I'm sorry.
Are you finished?
Well, I guess this is not as much a question as a reaction. I was once on a team at a state mental hospital. I was functioning as a chaplain, and we had nurses and doctors, psychiatrists, everybody around the circle. Is this analogous at all to the way we used to do things, where we would bring a patient in and have a discussion with that individual, and then after that individual left, we went on and had an awful lot of discussion ourselves? That couldn't happen here, because that incapable person would have to be there the whole time. We couldn't talk about them without them being in our presence.
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, I would interpret the way it's written there to require that the person be there for the entire discussion.
Senator Fisher?
Yes.
I don't want to belabor it either, because I do support the bill, but I just have a question, and that is, it's on page 4, and it's line 28 and 29. It says, this act is automatically revoked if the individual regains the capability to make healthcare decisions. Is there a process that is already in law, or how do we decide if they're capable of this, if they regain their capability?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shannon, there is a definition within the statute upon what's capable and what's not capable.
Okay, thanks.
I think we have someone else that wishes to testify. Could you identify yourself?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Holly Robinson. I'm here on behalf of Senior Disabled Services. We participated in the discussions with Mr. Mammon, who is the constituent of Mr. Simmons in support of this bill. The only piece that I would like to add to this conversation is this. In the quick regraying of our society and the demographic changes of and the aging of our population, the need for substitute decision makers is significantly greater than the amount of money that the public has to put into public guardianship programs, be it at the state level or the county level. We currently only have 2 counties that actually fund public guardian programs. That's Jackson County and Multnomah County. There is a burgeoning group of individuals who are willing to provide guardianship services for a fee, for a service, but there are many individuals in our system who do not have the money to pay for that. When Mr. Mammon's group was originally meeting in LeGrand, they were actually hoping to look for a public guardian program, and because there were not adequate funds available for that, either locally or they anticipated at the state level, they began to consider other options, and this only begins to cover a small group of individuals who will need some assistance in such a few decision-making, but I think it's an important tool to have. There are some of the safeguards that clearly can be addressed in the rulemaking process.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr.
Chair?
Yes.
If you want to come today.
If
you want to come tomorrow.
I don't think. My question here would be, how do you feel about, as SDSD, about, say, Mr. Judith's testimony that says that House Bill 3538 would allow the state to take away a person's right to make medical decisions based on the opinion of one physician that the person is incapable. The person receives no advance notice of the process, no opportunity to object to a disinterested decision. And this is important, disinterested decision maker. No right to representation and no right to appeal.
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, I have a sort of a multi-level answer to that question.
It's a multi-level question.
Good, I have multi-level answers. I think that in this process, we would anticipate, and through the rulemaking process, that an individual would have the ability to express their objections at sort of multiple levels, at the team level, at the placement of the individuals where they're living, to the people, to the significant others in their lives. And I think that that ability to object, which will be supported in the rulemaking process, would basically stop the process and create and put somebody in a process that has additional, leading to a court process basically that would allow that to happen. The practicality of some of this, I think, in some ways does drive my answer, because currently that's happening for lots of folks right now. Family members, other interested parties, anybody that a hospital or a facility is willing to accept direction from is what the practice currently is in many, many places. And I think that this, for those people who are now having decisions made without any process, this at least gives those individuals a little bit more process, a little bit more structure that doesn't currently exist. So the folks that I'm more concerned about are those individuals who are having those decisions made for them all the time currently and for whom nobody is speaking for them. And this at least creates a process that will allow those individuals to have somebody speak on their behalf.
Yes, thanks. Yeah.
My understanding that this bill does have a subsequent referral to judiciary?
No.
I thought it did. Okay.
Not to my knowledge.
Looks like it does.
Yeah. It does? It
looks like it does.
Okay, well, then I stand corrected.
I would like to see our judiciary committee take a look at this. I understand there's a problem and we need to address it. It sounds to me like it's also a funding problem for services for these folks, but I'm not totally comfortable with this, and I think it would be very beneficial to have our judiciary committee take a look at this.
I love it. It's great. You can pass this bus on to somebody else.
I'm very good. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3538 and open the work session on House Bill 3538.
I move House Bill 3538.
Need a -2 amendment, I believe.
Okay. I move the -2 amendment to House Bill 3538.
Senator Shannon moves the -2 amendments to House Bill 3538. Further discussion? Objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
And I move House Bill 3538 to the floor.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it has a subsequent referral to judiciary. You could request that subsequent referral be rescinded, or you could move it to judiciary.
Well, that's for a candidate anyway.
You want to amend it, I think. Mm-hmm.
My preference is to go. I mean, at the end of the session, and my attorneys have already looked it over, but if it has a referral to judiciary, then one vote won't do it. I can count. Send it to judiciary. And move to send it. Just get it out of here. Get it going.
Yeah, do you want to move, and then we can take a separate vote on sending it to judiciary?
Well, I I think probably you and I agree, and that's it. So I move setting it to judiciary. I don't want to be here tomorrow.
All right. Senator Shannon has moved House Bill 3538 as amended by the -2 amendments to the Judiciary Committee.
Further, the due pass recommendation.
The due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objections? Hearing none. Will clerk call roll?
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Senator Shannon?
Aye.
Chair Fisher?
Aye. Motion carries. Thank you very much, Representative Finnum, for your time and helping with this bill. This is a work session on House Bill 3538. An open and... I don't know if we're ready with 2581. House Bill 3192. Yes, please come forward.
Just need to hear them.
Please go right ahead.
Chairman Fisher, members of the committee, my name is James Wheeler. I'm Director of Columbia Adoption Services, one of the private Oregon adoption agencies. I'm also the legislative committee chairman for the Coalition of Oregon Adoption Agencies.
Regarding 3192 in its engrossed form, our agency does support this amended form of the bill that you see before you. We support all sections of the bill. In Section 1, as Mr. Wheeler stated, this is a reasonable modification of ORS 109-470, which requires continuing registration by the birth parent or putative father at the time the adoptee reaches the age of 18. The change proposed is that the parent would not need to re-register or notify the registry of the desire to continue to be registered, but would only have to notify if they wanted their names removed. SEOF also supports Section 2. This does remove the maximum fee allowable to charge persons who register with the voluntary adoption registry and for conducting an assisted search for another party to the adoption. Currently, those fees are $25 to register, $45 additional, or $45 to register for non-identifying information, and $400 for an assisted search. We do support these changes because we believe that fee standards are more appropriately established by Oregon administrative rules than by statute. We support also the changes to ORS 109-506 that are contained in Section 3 of the bill. The resulting statute would direct our agency to establish, again, by rule, standards for Oregon licensed adoption agencies that conduct searches under ORS 109-503 in the following areas: eligibility standards for those agencies, standards of conduct, contracting standards, search procedures, and the amount of fees to be paid by persons. These, as Mr. Wheeler and I were looking this morning at the existing administrative rules, what I anticipate is our agency and the coalition to work closely together looking at the assisted search rules that we have that establishes these kind of standards and seeing how we can adapt those to the registry. Under existing statute, the private agencies as well as our agency must establish and maintain an adoption registry for the adoptions that they do. SEF welcomes this opportunity to work again with the private agencies through the established network of which Mr. Wheeler is a representative. In summary, we can now support all three sections of the bill in its present form. We don't anticipate any measurable fiscal impact on our agency, although there will be a small workload impact that is associated with the development of the rules and working with the private agencies. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. I'll close public hearing on House Bill 3192 and Oak Clear.
I move House Bill 3192 to the floor with a pass recommendation.
Senator Duncan moves House Bill 3192 H to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Further objections? Discussion? Hearing none. Will clerk call the roll?
Any interior?
Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Duncan will carry the bill. Close the work session on House Bill 3192 and open a public hearing on 20, open a work, public hearing on House Bill 2581. Andrew, do we have anybody signed up for that? Oh, we have it here, okay. Morgan Allen.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2581 is measure that you looked at earlier this month. We have three amendments proposed that are all described on your summary. This is a bill that would require health insurance to cover cost of pregnancy and childbirth, basically.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Morgan Allen from Representative Piercy's office, and I just wanted to stop by and let you know that the Dash 5, 6, and 7 amendments to the bill have been looked over by all the concerned parties, including the folks from the insurance industry, and everyone is in agreement with those, and we would just urge that you adopt all three amendments and send it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And if you folks have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
You say that's the A5, 6, and 7.
Yeah, the Dash 5 amendments are a technical.
You should have all.
That's 7, yeah.
The Dash 5 are a technical change to the bill to ensure that, for example, automobile policies are not included in this. That was a mistake that we made. The Dash 6 amendments put a 6-year sunset on that, as most insurance mandates are required to be reviewed every 6 years, and we originally put a deletion of that sunset over on the House side, and I believe that the committee on the Senate side would like to see that looked at in 6 years. And the Dash 7 amendments are something that came up late, just to really clarify who is covered under this bill. Basically, anyone on the insurance policy should be covered, but there's what can only be termed as a bizarre attorney general's opinion from, I believe, 1993 that the insurance folks showed me, and we believe that we needed to have absolute clarification that anyone on the policy, their pregnancy would be covered. So they're all basically technical fixes.
Okay.
Mr.
Chair? Yes, Senator. Yeah.
Can I start moving the amendments?
Well, just a chance to get out of the public hearing. Yes. Senator Shields?
I just didn't want to leave because during the amendments, we might have a question.
All right. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2581A and open the work session on House Bill 2581A.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the Dash A5 amendments to House Bill 2581.
Okay. Which amendments again?
Should I just name all three of them?
That'd be fine.
Should we do it one at a time?
I'd appreciate one at a time, because I'd like to talk about sex for a minute.
Oh.
Unless we just do that first.
Let's do it.
Let's just discuss that first.
All right.
The Dash 6s are the ones that have the sunset.
Yes, that's correct.
And I remember in previous testimony that there were a whole group of women in here on the mammography bill, and they were saying, you know, the fact that we have to come back every 6 years, you have to organize our troops and all come in here, and they talk about what a hassle that was. I'm wondering, is it absolutely essential to have the sunset 6 years and have to go through that again? You passed it 59 to nothing on the House about a sunset. Why are we doing a sunset here?
My understanding, Mr. Chair and Senator Shields, was that at our last meeting, the representatives from the insurance lobby requested that, and so we drafted those amendments. We do feel that it is somewhat of a hassle. We would agree with that, but we don't want a hindrance of passage of this bill, so we agreed to go ahead and put a sunset on it, as we feel it would be very unlikely that they would come back and try to remove that. So.
I'm maybe mistaken, but if we decided we wanted to change this, doesn't the legislature have the power to do it without a sunset?
Our understanding is that's correct, Mr. Chair and Senator Shields.
I'm just asking. I don't want to get in the way of the bill either.
Well, there's
the wisdom of the committee, I guess.
There's a law that we have, and if you start picking and choosing, then who's the one that you don't choose? If you're not going to have it, I would suggest if some of you have objections to the sunset bill, that you would get a bill and direct that at all mandates and handle it once and for all. But I think it's very difficult to start picking and choosing, and I personally don't think there's anything wrong. It keeps the fact that there are costs and there are things that are caused by mandates that probably aren't wrong to review every now and then to keep the fresh in a person's mind.
I'm just saying, it's 59 and nothing without it. I'm just asking my question. I think it's legitimate given what happened in the House.
I'm ready to take a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that we pass, adopt the dash A5, A6, and A7 amendments to House Bill 2581A.
Senator Castillo has moved that we adopt the dash 5, dash 6, and dash 7 amendments to House Bill 2581A. Is there objection? Further discussion? Hearing none, so ordered.
Okay, just a second. I was reading the amendment is that then we would remove the sunset?
No.
Okay.
No,
the reason I say that, I know, I think of where you're going is, it passed. If I guess the success, let's go.
Yeah, I guess this would send it back to the House because we
any of the amendments.
Yeah, send it back anyway.
Let's go back anyway.
Mr. Chair, I move the House Bill 2581A as amended to the floor with a few pass recommendations.
Yes, I had banged together before the questions. So
okay.
Let it go ahead and question. I had given that
all. Okay, adopted all three sets
without objection. You wish you want to find out if people should be recorded as objections.
Did you wish to have an objection to that?
Yeah, I want to record an objection to six.
Okay. Well, clerk call a roll on the A6 amendment and the A5, A6, and A7 amendments to House Bill 2581. You've got to do it all three. We can't
say that. Okay. Senator Stanley?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Castillo?
Aye.
Chair Fisher?
Aye. Motion carries.
Okay.
We've got to.
We have to do the main bill now.
Yeah, that was true. Take care of the amendments.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2581A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Castillo moves that House Bill 2581 is amended with the dash 5, dash 6, and dash 7 amendments be sent to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Further objection? Discussion? Hearing none, will clerk call roll.
Senator Sanders?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Castillo?
Aye.
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye. Motion carries. Do we have someone to carry the bill? Mm-hmm. Senator Castillo will carry the bill. Thank you very much for coming. Let's see, we have 2690. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2690. Go ahead and come on up.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Holtz. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon State Pharmacists Association. I'm before you today representing the Statewide Pharmacy Coalition and includes all the pharmacy organizations in the state. As we have consensus amendments, I am not going to read this testimony. I'm just going to summarize for you. But we have arrived upon agreement to some rewriting of the bill that passed the House on a 42-4 vote. Namely, we are making changes to beef up a section dealing with a committee, had been a committee looking at child immunizations, and this will now be a task force that will report back to the legislature. And I wanted to be sure that I gave my thanks to Scott Gallant for his efforts to help us come to agreement, and Charlie Cheek for doing these amendments for us on very short notice in just the last day. We believe this bill has the potential to significantly improve public health by giving people one more place they can go to receive immunizations. This is really becoming the standard of pharmacy practice throughout the country. With this bill, Oregon will become the 31st state in the country where pharmacists would be delivering immunizations and vaccines to adults. To give you some idea of the potential, Oregonian recently reported that only 5% of the seniors on Medicare received their pneumococcal vaccines, which helps to prevent a particularly nasty form of pneumonia. It's a cheap shot that can save thousands of dollars in hospitalization costs. The immunization provisions in the bill have a number of safeguards in them, I believe. No one could do this practice without being certified and trained to do it. We have reporting requirements in terms of the immunizations and vaccinations being reported back to a primary care provider and to the health division. We believe that's very important because it is not our desire to in any way disrupt the medical home. In fact, we think this will enhance the medical home to some degree because it is not now common when there are flu shot fares and that sort of thing for those shots necessarily to be reported back to a primary care physician. So we think that will be an enhancement of what's going on now. The bill also does a few other things. It allows pharmacists to administer medications and devices under some very narrow circumstances. I'd be happy to go through those for you if you would like. But in the main, these clarify the legal status for liability purposes of practices that have been going on in the hospital and home infusion pharmacy practice for some time. And, I just summarize by saying, we expect this to require fairly careful and lengthy rulemaking, and hence our amendments also add an emergency clause so that the various stakeholders, boards, and so on will clearly be having the authority to get started on that process. We believe this is a good bill for public health, and I'd be happy to walk you through on pages 3 and 4 of my my prepared testimony. There's just kind of a section-by-section walkthrough of the bill. I'll be happy to go through that if you would like, but I'm mindful of the time. And I will just conclude by respectfully suggesting that the committee adopt these amendments, which have been agreed to by the Health Division, the Oregon Medical Association, the Oregon Nurses Association, and to send this bill, I would hope, to the floor. There was, I noted, a subsequent referral to Judiciary, and now that we have agreement amongst all the stakeholders and no disagreement that I'm aware of, we would hope that we could just send this right to the floor.
I have arrangements to send a letter. If this passes the group, to send a letter asking the requesting to take it out of Judiciary and send it directly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That concludes my testimony, and again, I'll be happy to just go step by step through the bill if you wish.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Scott Allen. I'm representing the Oregon Medical Association. Some wise legislator told me a long time ago, don't talk a bill to death. We're in agreement with this legislation. We will support your request for the subsequent referral to come off. It's amazing how those things happen. I would point out, however, that there is one editorial error in the amendments on page 2, lines 25 and 26. After the word pharmacist, the rest of that phrase was supposed to have been deleted, and we would respectfully request that the committee delete that. That was part of our agreement in these amendments.
25 and 26 on page 2.
Right. After the word
pharmacist,
delete the rest of 25 and line 26.
Mr. Chairman, Tom Holt again. Yes, in my case, to summarize, I neglected to bring that to your attention. We all concur on that.
So, to summarize my testimony, we agree with this and hope you move it out to the group hand.
Chair, I do have one question. Thank you. I'm wondering, now, will you be also helping patients to do self-administration injections, or will this expand to that service as well?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Castillo, yes, there is a provision in the bill that will allow a pharmacist to administer a medication in the course of teaching someone to self-administer. This would allow a pharmacist, for example, to assist a new insulin-dependent diabetic patient in showing them, you know, how to do their insulin shots if they're having difficulty. It's quite common for pharmacists to get inquiries from and requests from their patients, you know, for help, and right now they can only show them a piece of fruit or something, and it's often a matter of showing someone, you know, a more comfortable angle or a better place to do the injection.
Yes.
And so I'm just wondering what kind of training will take place, because it seems to me that, you know, that teaching someone else how to do it and when to do it properly, and then monitoring how they're doing with that self-administration program would be very, very important.
Senator Fisher, Chairman Fisher, Senator Castillo, two things about that. Number one, I can tell you that in about 3 weeks, our organization is going to be putting out a program for a nationally recognized program in diabetes care certification. Part of that training in the insulin administration. I can also just relate to you one anecdotal story. One of my board members,
I will make it very short.
His wife requires an injectable medication, and he has been helping her with it for years in their household. Someone who is not trained as well as a pharmacist can do that one-on-one with people and do in household situations, I believe. Here we have people who are very well trained in the medications and their effects and things. And nothing here could be done without rulemaking by the Board of Pharmacy, and we would expect and request that the rules require some training.
We're all required to bring reports to that workshop.
If I could just ask another real quick. And so what kind of oversight will take place, after we enter into doing this, then what kind of oversight to make sure that there aren't any medical problems or that there haven't been any things go wrong or mistakes made? How are we going to have oversight of that?
Chairman Fisher, Senator Castillo, of course, the Board of Pharmacy has oversight over all pharmacy practice, and any problem would fall into a category of errors that are required to be reported by law. We would expect there to be very careful oversight, not only by the Board of Pharmacy. I'm sure we will have the Board of Medical Examiners and the Health Division looking very closely over the shoulders of pharmacists on this.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Castillo, I would hope in the rulemaking process that we could develop a connection between the primary care physician or physician and the pharmacist where these circumstances occur. again, to make sure that there's communication between the two systems.
Right, Chair Fisher and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the State Health Officer and Deputy Administrator for the Oregon Health Division, and we are involved in this because the State Health Division is the one that's responsible for Oregon's immunization program. We did have a couple of concerns. At first, we wanted to make sure that if adult immunizations were being given by pharmacists, that they were done under standards and protocols that were well accepted, and that now is in the bill. Also, we do have some questions about when it is appropriate for children to be immunized by pharmacists, but we are more than happy to participate in a task force that will take a look at that over the interim and come back with recommendations for the next legislative session. So we're fine with the bill as it now stands. And just, again, after that last question, I think it is critically important that there is good lines of communication between the pharmacist and the primary health care provider so that everyone knows what is going on with that patient. And that is something that we plan anyway to make sure it's addressed in the rulemaking process.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I would just reiterate what Grant and Scott have said. It certainly is not our intent to replace anyone or to keep anyone out of the loop. We want to enhance communication between the pharmacy and the primary care physicians and other health care providers.
Grant, is it going to change majorly the going to a task force instead of a study group? Is that going to cost a lot more money?
Chair Fisher, I don't believe so. And Tom may have more to say on that, but I don't believe it would change the cost much at all, if any.
Mr. Chairman, Tom Holigan, for the record, the task force, I would note, is a volunteer task force, as was the committee. I think we've simply made a bit more formal the committee that we had in the 2690A. The fiscal impact for that would reside with the Board of Pharmacy if they're the convener of the task force, and their estimate on the bill as passed by the House was a little less than $50,000 for the biennium.
Thank you. Go from public hearing to on House Bill 2690 to a work session on House Bill 2690.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the Dennis 10 amendment, and so I'm going to move the conceptual the deletion.
I think we can move that deletion. I don't think that would be considered a conceptual amendment.
So, how do you want me to do it? Just move
the dash 10 with a deletion of a period after pharmacist and a deletion of and through not on line 26 and currently through service.
Okay, so moved.
Senator Duncan has moved that we accept the dash 10 amendment to House Bill 2690, and that in that amendment a period be inserted at the pharmacist on page 2, line 25. The words "and other health care providers" not on line 25 be stricken, and line 26 be stricken. So there's discussion, objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
I'll move it. I'll move 2690 as amended to the floor with two pass recommendations. Oh, yes. Yes.
With the subsequent referral to judiciary. No, we want that removed. We want to remove the subsequent.
That's right. We want to okay. With a request to remove the subsequent referral to judiciary.
Okay, Senator Duncan moves House Bill 2690 as amended by the dash 810 amendment to the floor Senate with a due pass recommendation, and also that we ask to have the referral to judiciary removed. Further discussion? Objection? Hearing none. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Field.
Aye.
Senator McHale.
Aye.
Senator Duncan.
Aye.
Senator Field.
Aye.
Chair Fisher?
Aye. I'll carry the bill, and then we'll have it as the motion carries, and we can carry on the bill. But what I did, I requested for another 15 minutes to finish so we don't have to come tomorrow, so I'm trying to do every way we can here to get this done, and then there'll be no question whether we can be there on time tomorrow. The work session on House Bill 2690, and open let's just go right directly to a work session on House Bill 3255. Do we have anyone that wished to testify on House Bill 3355?
We had a sign-up list.
Maybe we do.
Mr. Chairman, the House Bill 3355.
You can have invited testimony to the workstation. So.
Create the co-payment plan as a pilot project for the Oregon Health Plan.
Kirsch Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Kirsch Crawford, Director of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, and I'm handing out some prepared testimony, which I'm not going to go through in detail, but what I would like to do is briefly go through the bill and describe for you what it does. It requires that the Medicaid program implement a co-payment provision in the Oregon Health Plan consistent with Medicaid regulations. It requires that co-pays be charged for primary care services with certain exemptions. It sets this up as a two-year pilot project and then requires at the end of that two-year period an evaluation component or study to test the hypothesis that it is possible to use co-pays in the health plan and reduce inappropriate utilization of services but without reducing needed access to care. As I said, the bill requires co-pays on primary care services, and in putting our estimate of fiscal impact together, we have assumed that co-pays would apply to physician services, other practitioner services, visual exam, outpatient services, and prescription medications. Because the provision is required to be consistent with Medicaid regulations, co-payments would not apply to emergency services, family planning services, prenatal care, children, pregnant women, or people who are institutionalized. The bill would require an additional administrative impact on providers who would be required to not only collect but keep track of. Care services, and in putting our estimate of fiscal impact together, we have assumed that co-pays would apply to physician services, other practitioner services, visual exam, outpatient services, and prescription medications. Because the provision is required to be consistent with Medicaid regulations, co-payments would not apply to emergency services, family planning services, prenatal care, children, pregnant women, or people who are institutionalized. The bill would require an additional administrative impact on providers who would be required to not only collect but keep track of and account for co-payment collections. Providers would still be prohibited from denying care to somebody who could not pay the co-pay. However, that could subsequently result in reductions in access to care as providers might potentially refuse to see people in the future who didn't make the copay. We believe that there is a very small general fund savings in the bill as it is currently proposed. The savings is small for several reasons. One is because there's a significant amount of administrative costs to implement the provisions of the copay bill, not only in terms of systems changes that would be required to track copays, but also actuarial costs in order to implement the copay provisions within the managed care delivery system that we use, as well as fee-for-service, and in addition to paying for the evaluation required under the bill. savings are also reduced because of just inherently in the way copays work. It actually saves more money on the federal side than it does on the state side because 60% of the savings from copays accrue to the federal government as opposed to the state general fund.
How does that compare with the premiums that they pay? That also reduces the federal government 60%?
Mr. Chair, no, it's very different. With premium collections, 100% of that money accrues to the state, and 100% of our collections are a direct general fund offset to the operation of the health plan. With copays, 60% of the savings would go to the federal government, 40% would come to the general fund. Clearly, whether or not we have copays is a matter of legislative policy, and you have clearly the obligation to make that decision. I would like to point out, though, as you make that decision, that, as Senator Fisher has indicated, we already charge premiums for a significant portion of the people who are covered under the Oregon Health Plan. And during the 99-01 biennium, they will contribute approximately $13 million under the premium program to directly offset the general fund cost of operating the health plan. And at least for those individuals, the implementation of copays would represent a second cost-sharing requirement for coverages.
So this does not do away with the premium?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. This does not change the premium program at all.
How do you differentiate between who pays a premium and who doesn't pay a premium in the health plan?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, premiums are assessed against those people we refer to as new eligible people who are covered under the health plan because we expanded eligibility up to 100% of the poverty level. We also refer to them as people who are in the families categories or the adults couples category. There are no children who are assessed premiums, but it's approximately 85,000 adults who currently pay premiums out of the 350,000 who are covered under the health plan.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
It seems to me you're only saving $200,000 with the copay, and yet you raise $13 million with the premium. Isn't there some way to tweak the premium a little bit that would actually create more revenue? That's what we're doing this for. I know it's for to limit eligibility, but this doesn't seem worth all this hassle for $200,000.
This is only a pilot project, though, too. Is that statewide?
Mr. Chair, it would be. It is pilot in the sense that it is time limited, but it would be statewide.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
Senator. Hirsch, is this important to you?
No.
This is my question.
I'm going to momentarily close the work session on House Bill 3555A and go to House Bill 3603 with the work session. We don't have anyone to testify on it. We can get that one done. If we go too long here and have to be removed from our situation, we can at least work this and come back only on this one bill for tomorrow.
Okay.
So I'll do that right now. House Bill 3603 was to be amended as our discussion yesterday. Yesterday was to delete lines 29 through.
Yes, sir. It was on page 4, delete lines 17 through 28. That's the added section 9.
Yes.
That had to do with the split sample. So that language would be deleted by amendment A3. We have another amendment, A4, that just came to us that has to do with alcohol screening.
Now, this amendment, -3, we discussed pretty thoroughly yesterday, so I don't think it needs any more discussion. That was the removal of the line, section 9, line 17 through 28 of page 4. This new amendment, let me just describe it momentarily. It was discovered late yesterday afternoon that the original bill, not anything that we've done in this session but or any of the amendments, but the original bill itself, when it was done 2 years ago, left out the United States Department of Transportation National Highway Traffic Safety Administration tests that they already do that are not DEA allowed or, how should I say, sanctioned. And so this would put them in as they should have been put in 2 years ago. It's basically a housekeeping amendment, and we've checked it out with the Board of Health, and they're satisfied with this, and appreciate getting a chance to have this put in because it was a mistake and left out. So it doesn't change the effect of the bill at all. All it does is add the DOT standards and testing procedures that were in force and are in force now.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'll move the dash A3 and dash A4
amendments. Senator Shields moves the dash A3 and dash A4 amendments to Senate Bill 3603. Further discussion? Objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Do I move?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I move 3603 as amended in floor of the due pass amendment.
Senator Shields moves House Bill 3603 as amended with the dash 3 and dash 4 amendments to the Senate floor of the due pass recommendation. If further objections or discussion? Hearing none, will clerk call the roll.
Senator
Castillo?
Aye.
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Senator Shannon?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye.
Motion carries. We have a carrier for the
day. Yeah, she was out of the room. She can do it.
Yeah, right.
Just transportation. I'll carry that.
Thank you.
Motion carries. Close the work session on House Bill 3603 and open the... I'm going to go ahead and just open a public hearing on House Bill 3555. I would call Sylvia Cayley, Bob Junder, and Catherine White.
I need to go to the floor. Okay. I'm taking a little vote. I don't know if you want to work us today.
Well, we'll see how what yours is.
I heard that I don't see anything.
Give them a high sign of on the last hurdle.
All right. Not that I'm not interested, but I just won't.
Maybe there's two left.
Go right ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sylvia Cayley, and I'm with the Oregon Law Center, which is a not-for-profit law firm that represents low-income people statewide. The majority of our clients are members of the Oregon Health Plan, and those who are not probably are covered by safety net clinics or through charity care and other kinds of clinics. And we are extremely concerned about House Bill 3355. I've provided you with written testimony, and I just want to hit the highlights of that. We perceive 3355 to erect a barrier to care without providing any financial assistance to OMAP in administering the Oregon Health Plan. One of the major problems we see is erosion of access to preventive care, which is the bedrock of the Oregon Health Plan. People will not be seeking preventive care if they have to pay a copay. In addition, we are concerned that people who are unable to pay a copayment will end up in emergency rooms because they don't seek prompt care and they are become more sick, end up in an emergency room, which of course results in more costly care. We are very concerned about increasing the problem that has been observed called adverse selection. This is a situation that has developed particularly among the new eligibles of the Oregon Health Plan, where they seek care only when they're really sick because of the effect of the premium, which you have already heard about. And a copay could well further enhance that negative phenomenon. We have a lot of people on TANF who, all of the non-pregnant parents, will be eligible for this copayment. Many of them are working through employment development plans that require, as a part of receiving TANF benefits, that they have routine medical care, drug treatment, or counseling, and a copay on that would put them between a rock and a hard place of keeping their TANF benefit and be able to use the small benefit they receive to pay copayments. Right now, someone who receives TANF benefits for one adult and two children receives only $503 a month. That's if they get the incentive benefit for complying with all the rules and regulations as, surrounding TANF benefits. And even though their children may not be covered by the copayment, if they have health problems, and many low-income people do have significant health problems because they haven't had access to quality health care during their lives, and things have just built up. We are very concerned about the fact that this copayment would apply to primary care services, a term that is not defined in the bill. Primary care services include pharmacy. We have heard testimony that some providers may be less inclined to continue seeing someone who can't pay a copay. I would imagine that probably, yes.
If you'll excuse me for being rude.
That's okay.
I'm going to stop this, shut down the committee, and declare it's still dead right now. We don't have any support in it in our committee to pass the bill, so there's no sense in beating a dead dog to death. If that won't offend anyone, the chair will make that decision, and we will hereby thank everybody for being involved in our committee for this session, and thank the committee members, even though some of them aren't here. We've been asked to have a committee party with the House Health and Human Services Committee on June 2 rather than May 27, so at least the member that's here can have that on the record, and I will poll for the folks that are going to put that on and find out how many of us can come. So I would again thank all those that have come before our committee this year, and we've had a lot of good folks, a lot of good input, and I appreciate the opportunity to have worked with all of you, and with that, my thanks to the staff and others. We'll cancel tomorrow's meeting, and sorry, Ellie Jenny, I didn't give you one more chance to testify, but I guess this is the first time I've ever dismissed a committee in my legislative experience in this manner, but maybe there's a first for everything, and there's no use continuing on here if we don't have some kind of support for this bill. So with that, thank you very much, all of you. Have a good rest of the session. Keep track of your bills. Close the Senate Committee on Health and Human Services.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.